walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and this is a recorded version of Talking Animals produced remotely at the corporate headquarters in Jupiter Farms, Florida, while sipping on a quarantini. Or was that coffee? At any rate, today's edition will feature, among other elements, two interviews I recorded in recent days. The first, which I'll air in just a moment, is with William Nimmo, founder of Tigers in America, a rescue network that has relocated more than 250 tigers from private owners, roadside zoos, and other nefarious operations. Not surprisingly, given the nature of Talking Animals, I wanted to devote part of a show to addressing Tiger King, the Netflix documentary series that generated tons of chatter on social media, countless instant experts, a long string of think pieces, and unfortunately, at least an equal number of non-think pieces. This show has covered captive big cats for most of the nearly 17 years we've been broadcasting, including interviewing Carol Baskin 5 times, dating back to 2006, and as recently as January of this year. To my great surprise, a bit of footage of one of those interviews was included in the first episode of Tiger King. I've also attended numerous conferences over the years, including international conferences devoted to captive wildlife, where I've also served as interviewer or panel moderator. So I've developed a bit of expertise on captive wild animals, but arguably no one knows more about captive tigers in this country than William Nimmo. And given the frenzy of misunderstanding and misperceptions that Tiger King spurred, I wanted to wait till that frenzy died down, then invite Nimmo on to provide serious-minded, deeply knowledgeable analysis and commentary about the Netflix series. He knows all the players and knows all the issues, very much including the highly significant issues Tiger King failed to address. In this interview, Nimmo also briefly discusses being approached by one of the filmmakers, Eric Good, to appear in the documentary, an invitation he declined, and has some intriguing observations about Good. We'll hear that whole interview in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll air another interview I recorded recently, this one with Scott Trebatoski, director of the Hillsborough County Pet Resources Center. In recent weeks, I've been seeking to spotlight how COVID-19 has affected animal organizations in and around the Tampa Bay area. Trebatoski explains how the shelter has adapted amidst virus concerns and the stay-at-home order, which in a bit of good news, spoiler alert, has been a real boon to the numbers of folks fostering and adopting animals. We'll get that lowdown and more, including how easily you might adopt a cat or a dog, when we hear from Scott Trebatoski later in the show. Right now, though, let's play back the interview with William Nimmo, a baloney-free conversation about Tiger King and tigers. Recorded last Wednesday, this is William Nimmo on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals, Bill.
I'm happy to be here, Duncan.
So, as you know, I wanted to have a serious-minded, legitimate expert on captive tigers in America. That's definitely you. Assess Tiger King, including the issues it raises and fails to raise, really. But before we venture into that pretty often sordid world, I think it's important for context to find out about you and your background. So, in the realm of animal welfare, I think it's to say your professional background is highly unusual. What did you do pre-Tigers?
Kids and I worked here in the city, worked on Wall Street, and were completely unaware of anything to do with animals, and specifically tigers, before 2011.
And what were you doing on Wall Street, just for more specific sense?
Investment banking.
Yeah, okay. So how did you go from there? That seems like a big leap from investment banking to tigers. What lured you from Wall Street to tigers?
Well, it was sort of what we called a one-off incident. We became aware of a place in Texas called Wild Animal Orphanage, and it had unfortunately gone bankrupt, and it left about 300 animals homeless.
Oh, wow.
And not farm animals or companion animals, but actually wild animals. I didn't know anything about it or the business, and they said that it had been in bankruptcy for a year and a half, and most of the animals were placed, and the reason it didn't look good for the remaining animals was that there was no one that would take them, and specifically no one wanted the tigers.
So I guess that begs the question, especially since this seems to be kind of like have no bearing on what you otherwise were spending your days doing. Why did they call you?
Well, Wild Animal Orphanage didn't call us. We got called of just friends of friends that happened to be in the animal protection business, and specifically with tigers.
I see.
And told us about the problem with this place. We weren't sure what it was all about, but we were convinced it was real and it was not sort of a hair on fire animal story.
Yeah. And so I guess the friends of the friends thought, well, even though he's an investment banker, he may have some cause to feel concerned and maybe step up and help in some regard with the story of the wild animal orphanage.
Yeah, Duncan, we didn't have any predispositions or anything. We just felt that was strange and it was unclear, and we got on a plane and went to San Antonio, and we saw the animals, and they were in pretty desperate situations, and got a lawyer, and it was getting to the bankruptcy judge, and told the judge that we would take the tigers, and we got ownership transferred, and we took 7 tigers out of that place.
Wow. Well, again, for a first foray, that sounds pretty ambitious, really,
luckily, we didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah, that could have really complicated things. Yeah.
Yeah, but we did make a couple calls ahead of time, Humane Society, other people that were in that business and knew about animals, and specifically wild animals. So we weren't going in completely blind, and we know that we would be able to contact somebody that would ultimately provide a home for them.
Yeah.
We just didn't know whether or not the whole problem, the whole wild animal orphanage problem was real. So when we knew it was real, then we pulled them out, and we shipped 3 of them to Florida, and we shipped 4 of them to North Carolina, and thought that's what had to happen, because, and we don't know how true it was, but we were told that the judge or the court or whoever was in control, we're going to euthanize all the animals that remained at the end of the 2-year bankruptcy. So, again, don't know if it was real, but knew it was real for us, so that's why we pulled those tigers.
I see. Wow. So I'm guessing with that first unexpected phone call and unexpected flight and unexpected development of pulling the animals out and taking those 7 tigers, was that really kind of, does that mark the birth of tigers in America then?
I guess it does, because you can imagine that we didn't know anything about it and just sort of got involved in this. And we came back to New York and resumed our day jobs and didn't think a whole lot of it other than it was sort of a unique experience, and you know, it's not sort of believable, but it was a one-off. And then time passed, and then we got a phone call from the sheriff in Ohio, who said that there was a lady in Ohio who had 9 tigers in her backyard, and she had a gun, and she was either gonna shoot the tigers or shoot herself or shoot her neighbors. And social services was over there, and she was very distraught. And again, it sounds like a strange phone call, but they did say, were you the people that pulled the tigers out of Texas? And we said yes, so we wound up back on a plane again into Ohio and spoke to the lady, and she did really have the tigers, and she was extremely distraught, and we sat with her for a little bit, and really all she wanted to hear, Duncan, was that somebody was going to take her cats.
Okay.
She just, you know, she was just sort of beside herself.
Yeah.
And her name was Angela, and we spoke to her, and we took her cats out and relocated them to other places and other sanctuaries. And then we realized that this was the second incident, and then that was followed by Missouri, followed by Alabama. And then we realized that the Texas thing wasn't a one-off. There's a problem out there, and it's bigger than we know.
Yeah, and you were thrust right into it, it sounds like, with a couple of calls and then more calls, and pretty soon that's what you're doing.
Yeah, and really the challenge for us was not only taking the calls, but finding the places to take them to.
Yeah.
And because I still had a very good relationship with our research department, I had asked I asked the research department to scan or pull whatever files they could and tell me how many places were considered sanctuaries, because it looked like we needed more than two or three homes. And I was expecting to get sort of a list of a dozen people, and the list came back, and there was 130 places classified themselves, or called themselves, sanctuaries in this country. And then so we called the lawyers, and we said, we don't understand what's going on here. And after a few meetings, they explained to us that the word sanctuary is not a prohibitor when you open up a corporation. So you can open up a corporation in, like, Tigers in America is a corporation within New York State.
Yeah.
But if you were Attila the Hun and you wanted to open up a sanctuary called Heaven's Gate or whatever you want to call it,
right,
and it's processed by whatever state you're in, the attorney general or the people in the incorporation office will not challenge you.
Wow.
Right. Right. If you wanted to say you wanted to open up a volunteer fire department or, you know, sort of a medical facility or a church, you would go through a much more elaborate process to have a legitimate corporation. But if you just say you're a tiger sanctuary, that sort of floats right through.
Yeah, so you could basically just hang out your shingle, and back to your example, call it Tilla's Place or whatever, a tiger sanctuary, parenthetically, or whatever, and you're in business. Sounds like nothing legally standing in your way.
Yeah, you are absolutely legitimate as a corporation. And then what we also found out, it was a different set of attorneys, is that then the sort of bad guys then file, do an IRS filing to get tax-exempt status granted to them. And once again, when you do the filing to the IRS, there really is no IRS challenge. If you're filing yourself as a charity, they just say, are you doing public good? And everybody says they're doing public good. But they won't challenge you if you say you you want to care for tigers. Wow. It just, you will routinely be granted a tax-exempt status.
Yeah.
So in this list of 130, there's 100 of these organizations that have tigers and that have been in business for more than 5 years. I did have some search criteria, and that they are raising money, and they're pretty much not caring for them. They're breeding them or exhibiting them.
Wow. Well, let me let folks know, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is William Nimmo of Tigers in America, a rescue network that has relocated more than 250 tigers from private owners, roadside zoos, and other facilities. In the wake of the furor over Tiger King, I invited Bill on to assess the Netflix series, because he's a serious, authentic expert on captive tigers, and give us some context, which he's doing now. This conversation was recorded last Wednesday. So that must have been staggering, Bill, I'm guessing, to when you expected like a handful on that list to come back, and 130 came back, and almost all of them were, it sounds like, really just in the business of breeding tigers and getting into all the sort of dark side of that enterprise, that must have been eye-opening in the worst way.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite stunning, and not too many people knew everybody on the list, but based on us calling around, we were able to identify the 100 on the list that were not what they were supposed to be. And we actually went on the road for about 2 years and visited the other 30, and then spoke to them and made sure that they were true sanctuaries, lifetime care, no breeding, all of the other true sanctuary characteristics. And then that's how we came up with our top 10, and that's which is now expanded to 15, and that's pretty much who we deal with when we place the cat.
Let me just ask you to expand on that a little bit, Bill. What is, because these are among the many things that are blurry at best in Tiger King, so what is the criteria of a top-tier animal sanctuary, in this case, big cat or tiger sanctuary?
Just sort of the headlines are, there's no breeding. The top-tier sanctuaries, there's no breeding, no buying, no selling, no lending, lifetime care, very big deal, and no handling.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that probably rules out quite a huge percentage of those on that list, I would think, for sure. Well, with that in mind, let's kind of circle back, because already I think we've covered, or you've covered, so many things that I thought were so important, that are so important in the world of captive tigers in this country, that were never touched on or hinted at in the Netflix series. So Let's just spend a few minutes, if it's okay. I'd like to ask you to just kind of assess Tiger King. And again, most people listening now know that that's the 7-part, actually now 8-part Netflix series. So given that you've been steeped in this world for the better part of a decade, what was your overall reaction to the series?
Well, it was, it was entertaining.
Yeah.
I mean, right. We've been involved in this world for quite some time, and nothing in that series was a surprise to us.
Sure. But I think kind of tongue-in-cheek and stuff, but I think when you're saying it was entertaining, to me, that's part of the very problem in a way, is that most people watching it aren't remotely like you, don't have expertise. And again, I think no one could have anticipated it made this series, or Netflix itself, that when it got released, that everybody would be on lockdown and looking for things to watch and to binge watch and all kinds of stuff. So this thing, I think, grabbed people's attention like it might not have in another set of circumstances. I mean, either way, it was kind of sensational and sordid enough that it certainly would have grabbed people's fancy. But I think it was even more intensely watched and reacted to because of the timing. So what key information did Tiger King actually get right?
Well, it is an accurate presentation of the people that are in this business.
Yeah.
And sort of the, I don't want to call it the bad guy business, but that are in the breeding and distribution and exhibition business. I mean, that's the people that we know, and that's the people, and that's typical of most of the people that do that.
Yeah. So, and I guess the key thing, maybe more to the point, is I don't know how much they got right, but what would you say are some of the key things they got wrong or that they missed altogether, which if you got 7 series, 7 hours or so, and then they added an 8th a couple of days ago, I mean, that's a lot of potential time to get really important information out, but that's not necessarily what the filmmakers' agenda seemed to be. So what were some key things that they either didn't get right or just missed providing when they had maybe a golden opportunity to do so?
Duncan, that's a great phrase. That's a missed golden opportunity, I guess.
Yeah.
In terms of what they got wrong, I mean, a little bit of that is perspective, and it's what did the filmmakers, Erica and Rebecca, want to do?
Yeah.
Right? And I think, and I don't want to be inside their heads, but it seems that they wanted a reality show.
Yeah.
They didn't want a documentary about how sordid and brutal and abusive the business is. They wanted a show about controversy and about people. It wasn't about, you know, the fate of the Tigers. It was about the people engaged in this activity.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people I know were expecting, you know, oh, well, finally we're going to get the Blackfish for Tigers.
Yeah. Well, that was to hear Carol Baskin tell it, that's exactly how Eric and Rebecca, the filmmakers, pitched this to them, and so that they, because I guess they get approached not infrequently about getting involved with projects and documentaries and TV series and all kinds of things, and I think they say no to most of them, but I think they said yes for a few reasons, including that the fundamental, the sort of elevator pitch was that it was, according to the filmmakers, going to be the equivalent of Blackfish for captive cats and tigers. So I think that's part of how they agreed to participate and give them the kind of access that they had, and I think that's among the reasons, I gather, at least, that they feel kind of betrayed might be too strong a word, although that's not too strong from their standpoint.
I agree. I mean, it is not, in my observations of it or whatever. I mean, we know Blackfish. We think it did great work, and we think it had lasting impact. And Tiger King is just sort of the swamp people with tigers. it's reality. It doesn't have a whole lot to do, as I said, with making things better or actually talking about the fate of the cats.
Right. So with that in mind, I mean, Joe Exotic obviously kind of occupies the center of the series. I'm reluctant to use the word star, but I guess in a sense he would be considered sort of the star if there is one, if this is the reality show that you mentioned. Surely you've known about Joe and his operation for years. What does he represent to you?
Joe is is sort of the most extreme example of what we call a breeder-dealer. In the breeding system, there's tiers of breeding, tiger breeding, and it's all legal. And the most prominent are Joe is the largest of all the tiger breeders. And by breeder-dealer, we mean he not only breeds for himself and sells, but he has a nationwide distribution system. Same is true for Doc Antle, and same is true for this other place in Colorado, which is no longer there. But I guess the headline for Joe is he is the example of unregulated, no-limit breeding. Right? Yeah. You can breed as many tigers as you want. And he had over 200.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, you really, the series, again, the way it was framed or edited, or maybe it was shot this way with this intention secretly or otherwise initially, but either way, what resulted, it seems that the series really glorified Joe Exotic and the world of black market buying and selling of tigers, cub petting ventures, and tiger mills, really. Again, that's a world that you obviously know well, and some of us that just from the sidelines have covered some of this world for a while. But again, I think most people tuning into the Netflix series would have no framework, no context for this. And so, again, given the way that it was presented, instead of like a feeling of outrage and like, what about the tigers? What about the tigers? You get people rooting on Joe Exotic.
Right, right. I mean, if you want to go back to one of your other thoughts about what was not said or what was missed or what the opportunity was, there's no explanation of what a tiger mill is, and that's what Joe runs.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the constant breeding of cats.
Right. So people that care about animals by now probably have heard the phrase puppy mill. Same idea, right? People that just breed dogs and dogs and dogs and sell them now mostly through the internet. But this is the equivalent of that, right? Just constantly breeding tigers and generating as much income from that enterprise as possible.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And the commercial life of a cub is 100 days.
Yeah, and then they're too big and dangerous, I guess. Is that right, Bill, to still be in the petting?
Yeah, exactly right. They're too dangerous to handle, and they cost too much to feed, so they'll get dumped.
Yeah, jeez.
The other sort of, I don't want to say opportunities, but the other things that were sort of missing about the whole mill part of it is they didn't mention anything about the trafficking.
Yeah.
And the fact that these mills are connected, you know, and there's 50 of them in this country, and they move tigers between and among them.
Yeah.
Even as we speak.
Yeah.
Also the fact that it's not only trafficking tigers, it's their parts. Unlike other animals, the tiger's worth more dead than alive, because you can sell the skin and the teeth and the head, the paws.
Yeah. Yeah, well, again, add to the list of missed opportunities. I mean, again, it might not have been quite as sordid as what ended up being made, but there was really a truly fascinating documentary series that could have been made, focusing on a lot of these things that we're talking about now that were never even touched on, including that trade and that market, and God forbid the great value, if that's the right word, for tiger parts, and how that drives a lot of the commerce on this horrible, gigantic black market. And that kind of reminds me in a way, Bill, is that one observation I've heard and read a lot, an observation I happen to share, is that the Tiger King series seemed to suggest an equivalency between Joe Exotic, Doc Antle, and others of that ilk, and Carol Baskin, which to me is, and others, is really a false equivalency, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is quite false, and I guess you can, once you're the editor, you can decide to manufacture controversy to the extent that you want to, and you can, I mean, but that's an editing decision on the part of the people that do the film. I mean, and Carol is among the top 10 of people that care for her cats. We've been to her place. We've also been to Joe's place. And why they did not decide to show her habitat that she built to have the cats run around in, I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah.
That's an editing decision.
Right.
And on the other side, and she does provide lifetime care. And on the other side, I was at Joe's trial, and I watched Fish and Wildlife do the exhibits and digging up the five tigers on his property, all which were healthy, all which were were shot in the head at close range and all buried in a pit. I guess if they wanted to include, consciously they did a little digging, but they excluded the whole range of evidence that was presented by Fish and Wildlife as to what Joe did to those five tigers just because he needed some space.
Oh, wow. Well, just back to Carol a little bit, because I know her a little, not much. I've interviewed her on this show five times, dating back to 2006. And in fact, by the way, much to my surprise, I had no idea beforehand, but in episode one, there's brief seconds, but still brief footage of me, like a video piece, interviewing Carol in the studio of the radio station. I don't know really what it added to anything, but no one had ever mentioned me. No one ever cleared it. No one just, anyway, so that's just as an aside. But anyways, having known Carol a little bit and interviewed her all these times over many, many years, I just thought, again, she was portrayed very poorly, and the tone I just felt was disturbing. To me, there was like more than a little misogyny there. And anyway, I just, again, I think it, by now, I think we've already sort of established that the filmmakers had a clear agenda in mind that had nothing to do with really capturing some of the legitimate issues that go on in this world, and really just instead making something that was really going to fascinate and titillate people and give them a lot to talk about, including her missing husband and all these other things. And it's just, I guess it's hard to argue on some level the fact that this, for a few weeks at least, was the most watched thing on Netflix. So I guess they succeeded in whatever they set out to do, but I think it's really unfortunate and unfair, and again, a huge, huge missed opportunity, because there's still a great documentary, or documentary series even, to be made on this very topic.
Agreed. And hopefully somebody, you know, at least the general public is aware that it exists. Unfortunately, the focus is, you know, manufactured fighting between people and not a whole lot to do with, you know, what happens to the cats.
Yeah. And so when you were talking about the top 10, so is Big Cat Rescue, I mean, where do they sit on your list of kind of carefully evaluated and ranked sanctuaries?
Well, we don't rank them within the 10, but they are certainly one of the original good guys.
I see. Okay. And I'd be curious to know, Bill, although I think this might be a rhetorical question, but did the Tiger King filmmakers contact you at any point to interview you, to seek your expertise, to have your involvement in some way?
Yes, they did. Eric came up to me. I was at Ed Stewart runs a spectacular place on the West Coast called Performing Animal Welfare Society, and he asked me to make a presentation, which I did, and Eric happened to be there at the presentation, and along with his cameraman, and he wanted to interview me, and I said we have to talk a little bit more about what the objective was, and conversations got a little fuzzy. I mean, he seemed to be a nice guy, but I just didn't think that the right message would get out.
So you already, even just on sort of meeting the guy at a conference or whatever for a few minutes and him saying, hey, I'd love to interview you for my documentary series I'm working on, you just in that, I guess, initial conversation or two could sense that this wasn't necessarily something for you to put your stamp on or involve your credibility with.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. We get approached by different people, filmmakers and magazines and whatever, and it's a lot of times it's just people looking for content or freelancing or people looking for to do something sensational because it is with the cats.
Yeah.
And we're just very apprehensive about the message and the messenger.
Right.
And unless the conversations go well, we would pursue it. Not that the conversation didn't go well, it's just I didn't think the right message would get out.
Yeah, sounds like you had an intuition that this wasn't something for Tigers in America to be involved with.
That's correct. I mean, yeah. you can sort of tell that by the types of questions and then sort of how frenetic somebody is or how many questions they ask about the cats and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a nice guy, a bit harried, as cameraman as well, but I just respectfully declined.
Yeah, I gotcha. Well, again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm speaking with William Nimmo of Tigers in America, which has relocated more than 250 tigers from private owners, roadside zoos, and other facilities where tigers shouldn't really live. Concern about Tiger King and the frenzy of misunderstandings and misperceptions the series generated, I invited Bill on to provide some analysis and commentary through the lens of calm expertise and experience in this realm. I doubt there's anyone who knows more about captive tigers in this country, and this conversation was recorded last Wednesday. So we're in our final moment or two, Bill, but I think it might be useful maybe at this point, if you wouldn't mind recounting the story of buying a sanctuary and what happened afterward.
Yes, that was it was sort of the Colorado equivalent of GW.
Okay.
And the sanctuary was for sale, advertised in a newsletter. I'm trying to think of the name of the newsletter. Yeah, in the world of exotic animal trade and bartering and whatever, it was called Animal Finder's Guide, and I was given a copy of that, and I read through it, and I found out that there was a place in Colorado for sale, and called them up, and while it was advertised as a zoo, it was actually a breeding facility. So I pursued it, and wound up buying the place, and closing it, and shipping out the animals. A good number of animals, with 75 tigers, 15 other big cats, and other assorted bears and wolves, and then just closed the facility and sold the property.
So really, if I follow you, you responded to that ad, that listing, and bought the sanctuary with the express purpose of relocating all the animals safely and to good, safe places to be living instead, and then the idea was, once I've done that, I'm buying this place to shut it down.
That's correct.
And you might not feel comfortable answering this, Bill, but, I mean, you've talked about all kinds of things that you've done and trips that you've made and tigers and things that have had to be cared for and paid for and then buying a sanctuary. How much dough have you spent in the interest of saving and helping what is like a large number now, 250, 300 or more probably tigers? I mean, that's, I mean, you not just put in a lot of time and effort. I would imagine there's been more than a few dollars.
Yeah, it's more than a few. There are six of us here in New York. We're an all-volunteer organization. And in the last, since we started, I think the number is a little over 1.2 million.
That Tigers in America and or you guys personally have spent trying to help tigers, relocate tigers, improve their conditions, whatever it might be.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think that might be the very definition of putting your money where your mouth is, Bill. So,
Well, we do get help, and we are a charity, and if people want to help us in the work we do, you can go to tigersinamerica.org and dedicate and donate to the rescue fund.
Right. What I would was about to encourage people to do anyway. Of course, it's great if you want to support the work that Bill and his colleagues do. But also, there's some really great information, including like an incredible sort of spreadsheet that tracks for a number of years now and continues to track where tigers are going from, again, nefarious operations typically to proper, authentic sanctuaries, and all kinds of other information and videos and stuff. So if you're interested, even if for mostly the wrong reasons, in what you saw in the Tiger King, but you really want to learn about some of the more legitimate issues and some of the efforts that go on to combat the things that, again, largely were glorified in Tiger King, tigersinamerica.org is a great website, and there's also a Facebook page counterpart as well. So, Bill, I think we're sort of nearing the end of our time here, but I really, really appreciate being speaking with William Nimmo from Tigers in America. And, Bill, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me about this on Talking Animals today.
Happy to do so, and if I can be of any more help, just let me know, Duncan.
Okay,
you do great work as well.
Thank you. That's very nice. Thanks, Bill. In a moment, I'll play back my conversation with Scott Trebatoski of Hillsborough County Pet Resources Center, in which he provides an update on how things work at the shelter these days in the COVID-19 era. There aren't many pluses of being on lockdown, but one virtue appears to be the serious jump in the number of animals being fostered and adopted. Yay! We'll hear more about that in a moment. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner. This is a piece by Paul F. Tompkins, a very funny man of many talents. It seems he's got a bit of a beef with a certain faction of dog owners. Here's Apologize for Your Dog by Paul F. Tompkins in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
The scariest thing I've experienced lately is dogs. I never used to be afraid of dogs, and then I lived in this building, this apartment building, that made me scared of all dogs now forever, because it was like weird immersion therapy. It was like I was supposed to be scared of dogs, and I wasn't, and somebody wanted to get me there. Like, no, you're supposed to be scared of dogs. I know what to do. I'll put you in this crazy-ass building where everybody has an insane, vicious dog but you. That's what it was like. Everybody in this building was like, I missed a memo in the common area or something where it's like, let's all get crazy dogs. If you don't want to get one, check this box. And then I never saw that memo. Every day this happened, every day, I would be walking down the stairs from my apartment, and just as I was kind of like, you know, thinking, what is today going to hold for me? I would like turn the corner on the landing, and then, dog out of nowhere, barking, so angry at me. Why is he so mad at me? So mad. And it's like, well, what happened was, I would, of course, jump, you know, and then, I'll be perfectly honest with you, sometimes I would make a noise of some sort. Like I would jump and go, like that. What drove me crazy was the person whose dog it is, the person standing there on the other end of this leash, right? They would not apologize for the dog for what just happened. Like, they saw it happen. It's not like it was subtle, right? It's not like they were looking away like, oh, what's happening? Are you guys talking? We're not talking. This dog wants to have my face in his mouth. Never an apology. And it's not like I didn't give them the in for the apology either. I mean, I tossed them some nice fat softballs. You know what I'm saying? I made it easy. Just something like, wow. He certainly gave me quite a start, that dog that is your responsibility. Man, oh man. Whew, trying to catch my breath here. Oh, really scared me there. Me, a fellow human being with feelings and dignity. Whew, it's like I saw my life flash before my eyes. Oh man. I was so scared. I mean, I'm sure that the dog would apologize if he could, but as he lacks the capacity for speech, I wonder who will pick up the baton. Oh, of the three of us, who here is best equipped to apologize for what your dog has done? He's a dog. He's out. I am the person who is scared. Doesn't make any sense, really, for me to do that. Oh, what do your calculations tell you? Because I'm out of people. Nothing.
That was Paul F. Tompkins with a piece called Apologize for Your Dog, taken from his album Freak War. Now it's time to hear my conversation with Scott Trepetosky of the Hillsborough County Pet Resources Center. In an interview recorded Thursday, this is Scott Trepetosky on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals, Scott.
You're welcome.
So let's just jump right in. How has the coronavirus and the attendant stay-at-home order affected the Hillsborough County Pet Resources Center?
Well, we've been preparing to take in animals for people who are affected by COVID and not able to take care of them themselves. So we had to find a way to get freed up space because we're generally full. We generally have about 500 animals in the shelter. So we put out the plea for adoptions and fosters. We got about half our population out in foster within about 3 or 4 days. And within the first week, we had the majority of our shelter adopted out as well.
So yeah, I think I saw early on that there was curbside adoption. How did that work, first of all, and then how did that work out, secondly?
The curbside adoption has been working great. It's something that we've been thinking about for about 2 years to do, like, delivery, since the newer generation is used to doing everything online, and we saw this as an opportunity to put it in place as a trial, and I think we're definitely going to keep it after the COVID is resolved itself. We've had over 50 adoptions take place that way, and a lot of interest. It's sort of a nice way to expand our capacity, because when we're really busy, our lobby gets so full you can hardly stand in it.
In other words, is the curbside adoption policy still in place?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so walk us through. So let's say somebody hears this and says, you know what, I am absolutely ready. We've been thinking about it, and it's just time for the stay-at-home thing, and we're driving each other nuts, and we need to get a nice dog or cat here to help us out. Take me through the steps of how that would work from that decision that, yeah, they're ready to adopt to implementing it with the curbside adoption.
So the easiest way is we've created an online kennel that we call ADOPT, which stands for Animal Data Optimization, and it has all the records of the animals, all their medical records, all their behavioral records, and they can access that online. If they find an animal in that list that they're interested in, then they go on the website and send a request. One of our staff will call them back, take all the pertinent information so that we can get them set up with a county license and everything, get an appointment. They'll pull up front. We'll get them the paperwork to sign and give them their animal.
Wow. That sounds super, super simple and easy and great for the people adopting and great for the animals and great for you guys.
Yeah, it's been super successful. We thought there were going to be some glitches along the way, but we actually find it to be a very smooth process.
So here's a question that, if you know anything about shelters or adoptions, that I guess I almost feel compelled to ask, given how cool and simple this sounds. Have there been any animals that have come back since you started the curbside adoption?
We've had one or two, and the only reason I think that they are coming back is, as we get down to our last dozen or so animals, they typically are ones that have some behavioral issues. And while we try to coach our new adopters through it, sometimes the behaviors are more than they can handle. So we just tell them to bring them back and we'll continue working with them.
Yeah. But it sounds like a very, very small percentage thus far. Considering.
Oh, yeah. I think it's only been one or two.
Yeah. No, that's great. So how many animals then are there currently at the shelter?
So the shelter currently has about 20 dogs and about 10 cats.
Wow, those seem like small numbers.
Yeah, especially because our daily numbers average between 400 and 500. So for our staff, this is a time for us to get in and do some maintenance in the kennels, because we typically don't have the time and we don't have the space to get in and like repaint or do any improvements. So we're hoping on the other side of this event that the cages will be all safe, all clean, all repainted, and it'll just be a better environment for the people and the animals.
Well, so in some ways, there's rare amongst the coronavirus world, there's some pluses to this. A good number of animals have been fostered and adopted out. We'll get into a couple more details of that in a sec. But it also sounds like it's given you guys a chance to really do, you say, maintenance, upkeep, painting, other preparations that otherwise so overwhelmed with the sheer number of animals and activity that you just, that's probably always on a to-do list, but never been able to get to that to-do list.
Yeah, it's been the silver lining that our staff has really been taking advantage of. The other thing that we've been doing is taking advantage of online courses. All of my staff currently is fear-free shelter certified through an online course, and now we're starting to work online to become certified vet assistants. So we're just trying to improve their skill set. So coming on the other side, they'll also be better trained.
So speaking of that staff, how does that work for staffing at the moment with the stay-at-home order? Are employees taking turns coming in while others work at home, and or how does that play out?
So currently we have the staff split into two isolated sections. We call them Group A and Group B. And what happens is 1 week they work 4 tens, the next week they work 3 tens in the shelter and 1 at home, and that 1 at home is when they're expected to do all their online training. And so those two groups never meet, so it's been a communications nightmare, but we're trying to learn how to do that to make sure that, you know, one group isn't doing something the other one, and we've learned how to do teleconferencing and keeping like logs so that the new shift knows what the other shift did.
Yeah, sounds like some logistical stuff to kind of straighten out, but it sounds like it's settling into a nice groove. So with the alternating staffs, what happens, because it sounds like there's fewer folks on hand or on site than normally with that rotation. So what happens to animals, missing pets, strays, and so on that would normally be brought into the Pet Resources Center?
So our animal control folks are picking up anything that could be potentially dangerous to people or pets, and anything that's sick and injured that needs to get immediate care. Then we have a diversion and retention team that's been working with a lot of very nice people who might have picked up a stray in their neighborhood, helping them find possibly the owner in their neighborhood and asking them if they would keep them until the other side of the virus. We'll get them food and whatever medical attention they need, like vaccines, so that they feel safe. But the public has really responded great. We've not really had any issues where animals need to come in that we haven't found a way to get them cared for.
That's great. And really, it does sound like, as when you hear about and read about in many shelters scattered across the country, that, again, I guess another sort of virtue of the COVID-19 is that it does seem to have spurred a number of more adoptions than would be customary, but also much more in the way of fostering.
Yeah, we have between 4 to 5 times the number of fosters we normally do. So that's something new for us, and it's something we're definitely investigating how we might be able to utilize that to expand our capacity on the other side. But the other thing that's been great with adoptions is we've made contact with people who've never been to the shelter before, and so we're expanding our customer base, and we're getting a lot of nice online comments like, oh, I didn't believe how great of an animal I got at the shelter. So we're hoping that that means longer term we'll be able to save more lives.
Right. So it might be too early to identify any clear-cut results or much less trends. But what's your sense of how many, given this big surge in foster situations, how many of those are becoming adoptions in this COVID-19 era?
So we suspect that all of our fosters will become adoptions.
Wow.
We've had about 15 to 20% actually become members of the foster parents' home already, and we've been featuring them online, and as soon as we feature them, we've got someone coming in to get them. Right now, our live outcome for dogs is at 95%, which is our highest ever, and it's good for a large public shelter to have that kind of outcome.
Sure, that's a gigantic percentage. That's great. So just in our last moment here, Scott, any particular story? I mean, these situations often bring about a particularly compelling story or two about a foster arrangement or an adoption, of course. Does a story like that come to mind that has developed just in the wake of all the COVID-19 adjustments to how things operate there?
Yeah, we had this one dog that really displayed poorly in the kennel. You know, some dogs just don't take the shelter environment well, but we knew when we took him out into play groups he was doing fine. So a foster saw the dog in play groups when they drove by the shelter, because we have a fenced in area right in front. They stopped by and took it home, and then 3 or 4 days later we got pictures of it laying down with their kids and their kids playing with it, and now it's become part of their family.
Wow, a nice transformation.
Yes, it was.
And a lot of odds makers there might have said, hey, I don't know if this dog can actually make that transformation, but that's part of the magic of animals and when they find a new home. Yeah,
it is. It's great, and we hope to continue seeing stories like that, not only during this difficult time, but for the future.
Yeah, cool. Well, Scott, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Scott Trebatoski. Again, he's the director of the Hillsborough County Pet Resources Center. And as you've heard, there are fewer and fewer animals there, but there's still animals. If you're thinking of fostering or adopting, and you can just find out those details, as Scott outlined, online, and find your new family member today. So thanks again, Scott.
Thank you.
Coming up at 11 on WMNF, it's Rob Lori with Radioactivity. Meanwhile, on today's show, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a copy of There Are Birds, a terrific CD by singer-songwriter-birder Stephanie Seymour, a guest last year on Talking Animals. If you love great music and or birds, you'll love this album. Once again, we'll be doing it a bit differently today. Rather than call if you know the tune, please email me at duncan@wmnf.org with your guess of the song title. I'm Duncan Strauss, and you are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. And again, there will be a prize, that Stephanie Seymour CD, There Are Birds, to the first person who emails duncan@wmnf.org and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF.
The highway that's leading me. Now we
time to hear a short animal song. Why not one from the aforementioned Stephanie Seymour and her fantastic album There Are Birds, featuring musicians from the E Street Band and Ian Hunter's Band. Here's Ruby Crown Kinglet from Stephanie Seymour on Talking Animals on WMNF. About reach the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I invite you to return next Wednesday at 10 a.m. for another edition of the show. I also invite you to visit talkinganimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there too. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Instagram page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow me on Twitter and Instagram. You can also subscribe to our newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Rob Loray is up next. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond.